Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on yet another gloomy January day in Minnesota. These proceedings are being recorded, so when you start, please state your name for the record and who you are appearing on behalf of. You each will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant chooses to use it. And with that, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honors.
And I should say the first case is A22-0961 in the matter of SAA versus SD in Hennepin County Intervenor. Oh, and the podium goes up and down. And you can see you can either use the center one or the one closest to your desk, depending upon your comfort level.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors, opposing counsel. May I please the court? My name is, Erica Donner, and I represent appellant Serena Obrecht. I do want to note for the record that I've changed firms since this matter was filed, and I'm now at Gape and Larson and Johnson. My contact information has been updated with the Court of Appeals as well as with the District Court. I will refer to Ms. Obrecht as appellant or mother and Mr. Davis as respondent or father. We are here today on mother's appeal of the District Court's post-trial findings and order in this paternity matter. Appellant mother respectfully requests that this court reverse 4 findings or orders of the District Court. The District Court's award of joint legal custody, the District Court's finding that respondent father did not commit domestic abuse, the District Court's changing the minor child's last name, and the District Court's order that mother disclose her address to father despite her enrollment in the Safe at Home program. I will address these in reverse order. First, the District Court abused its discretion when it ordered mother to disclose her address to father despite her enrollment in Minnesota's Safe at Home program. The legislature established the Safe at Home program, codified in Chapter 5B of Minnesota statutes. The program is administered by the Secretary of State's office, and that office has promulgated rules for the Safe at Home program, which are found in Chapter 8290 of Minnesota Administrative Rules. I'll discuss relevant sections of Chapter 5B because the plain language of the statute is very important, Your Honors. The findings and the purpose of the Safe at Home program are found in 5B.01, which states that the purpose of this chapter is to allow individuals to escape from, quote, actual or threatened domestic violence, sexual assault or harassment or stalking, close quote.
Could you flip your arguments? Because it seems to me that whether or not the district court was wrong with regard to the domestic abuse is what helps us answer this fourth issue.
I understand that you would ask that question, Your Honor, but I respectfully disagree. And the reason for that is because the Safe at Home statute defines domestic violence, not domestic abuse, which I'll get to, and there's a distinction between the two, and that is very specific in the Safe at Home program. You do not have to be a victim of domestic abuse as defined in 518B.01 to be able to participate in the Safe at Home program. And that is very specific in the statutes in the Section 5B, because 5B.01 says that it is actual or threatened domestic violence in addition to harassment, sexual assault, or stalking. It is not at all domestic abuse as it is defined in 518B.01.
And so you are saying that your client was on the receiving end of threats of domestic violence. Is that your premise?
Yes, Your Honor. And so not only was she on the receiving end of threats of domestic violence by father respondent in this case, but the Safe at Home program does not specify that it has to be this specific person for which she is fearful of to be able to participate in the Safe at Home program.
Who else would she be in fear of, though?
There's testimony in the trial that the custody evaluator said that appellant is actually conflating abuse suffered by the father of her non-joint child, not father respondent in this case. So that is also part of the Safe at Home program's goal, to prevent appellant's address from being out there.
Was that issue raised before the district court, though? I thought the focus was on respondent father?
For the purpose of domestic abuse, absolutely. And the response to the question of was the issue...
No, my question is in terms of the Safe at Home program and why she shouldn't have to disclose that information to respondent father. Wasn't that in relation to the allegations of either domestic violence or domestic abuse from father?
Your Honors, there was not a single word of testimony about the Safe at Home program in the trial. Not at all. The only reference in the record to this appellant's participation in the Safe at Home program was from an affidavit that she had filed earlier in the matter.
I was going to ask you about that because you ask us to look at the affidavits. I don't know that they're part of the trial record. I was wondering what your legal basis was for us to look at some of the earlier affidavits that she ran out of time. And
yes,
so I don't know that those affidavits are properly before us or were properly before the trial court.
That's fair, Your Honor. I think that I referenced it for two reasons. One, to potential, because it is in the district court record, maybe not in the, it's not in the trial record, but in the district court record. And then second, because there was that gap in the transcript that unfortunately we don't have a portion of the transcript. And there's agreement, I think, that most of that testimony was about the naming of the child and non-domestic abuse issues.
And I think you said that we could look to the proposed findings to fill in that gap in the recording.
Yes, Your Honor. So I think it's really important. That's also part of the argument why the district court abused its discretion in ordering appellant to disclose her address to respondent, that there was not a record created at all about that she was even on notice that the Safe at Home program was at risk of being an issue in this case. As was...
The disclosure was only to respondent father, though.
Correct, Your Honor.
But so it wasn't to this other person that she was conflating domestic abuse or violence from?
Absolutely, but the purpose of the Safe at Home program is that the participant not have to disclose his or her their address to anyone. Not to the court, not to government agencies, to anyone. And that's why there's this address that she can use instead. And having her address out there with one of the fathers of her children means that he could then disclose it to somebody else. Sure.
The court ordered him not to.
But that's different than not having the address in the first place. If I had a dime for every court order someone's violated, that is the defies the purpose of the Safe at Home program.
But I mean, counsel, my understanding of your argument was not that the court couldn't disclose it. It's that the court needed to comply with Section 5B.05, and that because she was enrolled in the Safe at Home program, that therefore there were some other statutory factors that for the district court to disclose the information, the district court needed to conduct that analysis to decide that it was going to disclose the address to father, not that there were no circumstances under which father could get the address. Am I wrong about that?
You're a little bit incorrect in that that is absolutely part of our argument, but it's a level that is built on top of each other. So if the court decides that the district court made sufficient findings or that there was evidence presented that would have allowed the district court to force appellant to disclose her address. On top of that, they did not follow the procedures of 5B.11 that required notice to appellant. At any point in time in the many, many years of the history of this litigation, father never so much as asked the court to disclose appellant's address until his proposed findings post-trial. There was not an issue that the trial court stated was going to be an issue for trial. There were many temporary motions in this case. That temporary motions were not, at no point in those temporary motions did he ask for disclosure. So this newfound request for disclosure, mother didn't even have a chance to defend against that. And that notice is certainly required by 5B.11, in addition to the other reasons that the district court should not have forced appellant to disclose her address. as well. So it's a two-pronged argument that and the arguments aren't mutually exclusive.
Is it your contention that the district court was on notice that she was a part of the Safe at Home program?
I think so, yeah, because she had in this affidavit, she stated in a prior affidavit, I believe from 2018, that she was a participant in the Safe at Home program. But it wasn't an issue because the parties never made it an issue. And so absolutely she should have had at least notice and an opportunity to state the reasons why her fear and association of, I think arguably respondent father was sufficient enough, and even if not respondent father, other people to not force her disclosure of the Safe at Home in the Safe at Home program.
But you get the notice from Section 505B or Section 5B.05, excuse me, that she was entitled to notice so that, right? I mean, that's...
I think it was 5B.11.
0.11.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So 5B.01 is the findings and purpose of the Safe at Home statute, and 5B.02 is the definitions, and that's what I talked about earlier, that it's really important to acknowledge that the legislature has distinguished between the definition of domestic abuse in 518B.01 and domestic violence, which is what the Safe at Home program is, which is domestic abuse and a fear of domestic abuse, a fear of stalking, a fear of harassment. It is not just domestic abuse. It is a very, very broad definition, which is how the court should have gotten into an analysis of weighing the individual factors.
Why isn't the district court's analysis here finding her testimony on the domestic abuse allegations, including threats? It wasn't just allegations of domestic abuse, but it was more, I think, along the lines of threats. Why doesn't that satisfy the definition of domestic violence?
You're saying because the district court found that those findings exist, or that the district court ultimately found father to be more credible than mother?
Well, the district court found father to be more credible, found the evaluator to be more credible, independent, neutral third party, and found mother not to be credible in her allegations of all the various threats. I saw them as threats primarily, not domestic abuse itself. But the district court found those threats not to be credible.
So I don't think that the district court found those threats to not be credible. I think the district court found those threats to not meet the definition of domestic abuse, which is very different than not meeting the definition of domestic violence under the Safe at Home statute. And also,
but it seemed like the district court found that those statements, while they may not have been necessarily appropriate, but that mother understood them to be made in jest, that those were not actual threats that were being made to her.
Well, that's very much contrast to mother's actual testimony that she
didn't
interpret
them. It is, but the district court didn't find her testimony credible, though.
Well, just on an objective standard, but the Safe at Home program statute is not an objective standard. It is a very subjective standard. It is based on the participant and the enrolled participant's subjective belief and fear. It is not of stalking and harassment. And I don't want to lose that it is not just about domestic violence. And there's
you mean domestic abuse?
Excuse me. I mean domestic violence, because the Safe at Home statute is domestic violence, which includes domestic abuse, but also includes a lower standard of fear of domestic abuse, which is different than the fear that's required to meet the definition of domestic abuse under 518B. So stalking and harassment also are reasons that you can have a Safe at Home address.
Even if somebody has fear of that, but there's no basis for it, though, that's why I'm struggling, because doesn't that fear have to have some type of basis?
I think that it's a huge stretch to say that there is no basis. There's testimony in the trial record that respondent father would show up to exchanges for the mother's non-joint child. That and mother interpreted that to be harassment. There's additional.
Did your client? I recognize that she's representing herself. She didn't file a new trial motion.
She did not, Your Honor.
And so, our standard of review then is much more limited than if she had filed a new trial motion.
Well, I think that had she been afforded the same deference during the trial with questions like, do you want to continue for the next day, that she would have had a much better understanding about what she was getting herself into in the trial itself.
That may be the case, but on review now, we are left with, is there record support for the district court's findings?
Agreed. I entirely agree with that, yes. So appellant is asking this court to issue a ruling that a district court does not have the ability to order a participant in the Safe at Home program to disclose their address merely on the basis that that person is the parent to a minor child that lives in the participant's home address. There is nothing in statute and the administrative rules promulgated by the Secretary of State's office, absolutely nothing that says that this is a basis for forcing someone who is a participant in the Safe at Home program to disclose their address. And that is the entirety of respondent father's arguments.
And you are past your 15 minutes. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Do you see the clock on the...
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Michael Ortner, O-R-T-N-E-R, for respondent Stephen Davis. And may it please the court, I'm here to advocate on behalf of Mr. Davis in response to appellant's arguments. I would, unless the court has another idea, as it did with the appellant, I would go in the order that the issues were addressed in my brief, starting with the name change. The standard of review is that the change of child's name, surname, should be granted only when the change promotes the child's best interests. And there are five factors involved in that analysis. They're the Saxton factors, essentially. And in her brief, appellant says that the court did not address those factors. And in fact, the court very specifically did address those factors. Those factors are, first, the child's preference. In this case, the child is 3 years old. I think there's no doubt that the child is too young to express a preference or a knowledgeable preference. The length of time that the child has had the name, that one kind of piggybacks on the child's preference, but the court acknowledged that the child has had the name Athena Aria Albrecht since her birth 3 years prior. The degree of community respect associated with the present and the proposed names, the court, again, found that there is no difference in the degree of respect. I think that's a little bit of an archaic factor, because I think it maybe harkens back to a time when different nationalities were treated different. I'd like to think we're beyond that as a society. And that fifth factor, difficulties of harassment and embarrassment that may arise in the court, I think it's not disputable that there's no real evidence that that would be an issue here. So the only issue at hand is the effect of changing the child's surname on the preservation and development of the child's relationship with both parents. And there was testimony given by Mr. Davis saying that he preferred the child's name to be his name, Davis. Now, it was a little bit confusing because at trial he said that he wanted the child's name to be Katana Tanya Davis. He backed off that in his proposed order. And the net effect is that he was just asking that the child's surname be changed to Davis. And the district court, using the Saxton factors, said that this was the second factor I was talking about, that it promotes the relationship with both parents because the mother chose the child's first and second names, and the third name was the father's name, and that the child's half-sister also had her father's surname. So this is right in line with the Saxon factors.
Counsel, here's my question is, how I understand appellant's argument is that because your client changed his position in post-trial briefing, that she was deprived of an opportunity to specifically create a record on the difference between the hyphenated name or two names versus just taking your client's last name. Why isn't that persuasive?
Because the fact that the record would support a different finding by the court does not relegate that finding to be incorrect if the record also supports the finding made by the court. Here, admittedly, the court would have, or the record would have supported changing the child's name to either Davis or to Albrecht Davis. I believe that the respondent's request was that there'd be no hyphen, just be Albrecht Davis. The record would have supported either of those outcomes. The district court chose just to use Davis. So the fact that it could have gone another way does not compel the conclusion that the finding was incorrect.
Well, I think appellant's argument is that she never had an opportunity to argue about Albrecht Davis versus Davis because she had to brief the name that your client had proposed at trial, and therefore, you know, she didn't have an opportunity, right? I mean, and I understand your point, which is the district court had a record on the various names, but I think the point is whether that change in position deprived appellant of an opportunity to, you know, make an argument to the district court.
Respectfully, I do not believe so, because the crux of respondent's argument was that he wanted the child to have the same surname as him. And that is the outcome that we were gonna reach regardless of whether it was simply Davis or if it was Albrecht Davis. So in the arguments at trial, he said, I want the child's last name to be Davis. So appellant was on notice that that was what Mr. Davis was asking for.
So please address appellant's argument that the district court did not follow the statutory procedures for disclosing her address.
Well, for a first point I'd like to make is that I disagree with counsel that the definition of domestic violence in the Section 5B is different than the definition of domestic abuse in Section 518B, because in 5B.02, the statute says that domestic violence as used in the statute is defined as an act defined in Section 518B.01, Subdivision 2, Paragraph A, and includes a threat of such acts committed. Well, 518B.2A says domestic abuse means the following: physical harm, bodily injury, or assault, or the infliction of the imminent fear of physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. That's the threat. So the language is slightly different, but the outcome is the same. The infliction of fear is a threat of domestic abuse, or as they say in 5B, domestic violence.
Counsel, can you point me to any law that says a district court's decision with regard to domestic abuse under 518 can undo the Secretary of State's certification under the Safe at Home program?
Admittedly, no, I can't. And the case law on Section 5B is unfortunately sparse. And I think that I would understand the court's decision here to remand that, but I think if it is remanded, then the proper way to handle it, the district court, is to require Mr. Davis to bring a separate motion seeking the disclosure of the address so that the parties can brief the district court so that if we end up here again, there will be a better record on this issue.
And that would be a motion for the district court to apply the 5B.11?
Yes.
I have a question along those lines, counsel. Is that issue even properly before us? Because I don't think she raised that at trial.
You're correct that she did not. And with my duty of candor, then I can see the argument that that issue is not properly before the court because it was not properly before the district court and it was not argued at the district court, which is why I think that if with the issue is to be addressed, the proper way to do it is to have the district court take it up anew.
But counsel, your client was on notice that appellant was in the Safe at Home program?
Yes.
And you asked in the post-trial, your client asked in the post-trial motions for the address to be disclosed?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
So, I mean, there certainly isn't a record that the court and your client were on notice that she was in the Safe at Home program, and by asking for the disclosure of the address, that may trigger the statute 5B and the requirements in Chapter 5B.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, I just want to come back to the point I raised earlier. I just, you know, one of my concerns is addressing the issues that are properly before us. And so I just, you know, we're only an error correcting court, and as Judge Riley pointed out previously, because of the no new trial motion being filed, our review of the record is very limited, is limited even more. So I'm curious as to your position as to whether or not this issue is properly before us in order to be able to address, and if so, how should we address it?
I believe it is properly before the court because appellant raised the issue in her appeal, and so respond.
Right, but issues that are raised for the first time on appeal, we generally don't review because there's no decision by the district court on that issue for us to determine whether or not an error has been committed or not.
But here there was a decision by the district court because the district court ordered that the address needed to be revealed. And admittedly, that issue was not raised until the post-trial briefing, but it was addressed in the court's final order on the trial.
How do you respond to appellant's argument about how her ability to present her case was limited and she was given the short end of the stick at the end of the first day of trial?
At the end of the first and only day of trial, the net result was that she had more time to present her case than Mr. Davis did. And the district court told her at least three times, Ms. Albrecht, if you want to cross-examine Mr. Davis, you're going to have to reserve some of your time. And Ms. Albrecht responded in a way that would suggest that she understood that that was one of the ramifications of her going on with her own testimony. And at the end, when the court, you know, or when counsel for Mr. Davis said that I'm out of time, she in fact still had more time if they were going to be given equal amounts of time. But she opted instead to rest her case. That was a trial strategy decision, just as Ms. Albrecht's decision to use up all of her time on her own testimony was a trial strategy decision. That trial strategy is not something that the appellate court is here to review. That's something for the party litigants to live with. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
I think so.
The point to emphasize is that the district court said multiple times, Ms. Albrecht, you need to allot your time and save time to cross-examine Mr. Davis if you would like to. And at no point did she do that. And so here we are with both parties having not as much time as they would have liked, both parties were unable to cross-examine the other party. But the bottom line is, all of the issues that were to be addressed were addressed by both parties and by Mr. Chenander in the direct testimony.
And as I understand the trial record, the court initially set 2 days for trial because there were a lot more issues.
Yes,
including custody. And then the parties were able to resolve that major issue through mediation, and the court then said, we don't need 2 days, you'll have 1 day. Is that right?
That's correct. And if you have any experience in family law, you'll know that parenting time and custody are the two issues that chew up the most time in trials and motions.
Counsel, I just want to acknowledge, I appreciate your candor on the other issue that we've talked about in the Safe at Home program, but the underlying aspect of that is the whole domestic abuse issue and the findings of the district court. And we haven't had a chance to talk with opposing counsel about that, but how are those findings supportive not only of the domestic abuse, but of do they also satisfy the requirements of the stay-at-home program?
I believe they do, Your Honor, because if we were to go back to the district court and have a motion on the 5B issue, then essentially we'd be raising all the same arguments that were raised concerning domestic abuse in the trial. And the court determined that Mr. Davis's comments about choking and killing you were made in jest. And Mr. Chenander agreed with that, and Mr. Davis testified to the same. And then the court found that there was no credible threat of domestic abuse. And some of the issues that Ms. Albrecht raised in her affidavit, and we are not opposing the admission of that affidavit because we don't think that it really benefits Ms. Albrecht, but she raised issues such as just swearing and name-calling stuff, which is bad communication, but it's not domestic abuse under either 518B or 5B. And I see my time is up.
Any more questions? Thank you. Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. One of the important things that I feel like has been lost in the discussion that appellant did not have an ample opportunity to present her case is that she testified first. This was a very unique situation where she was actually the petitioner in this paternity matter. She did not have a chance to even so much as rebut the testimony of respondent father. It's not surprising that someone is found to be more credible when their entire testimony is after the testimony of the other person.
Well, except that the district court had the benefit of Chenander's report.
Yes, the district court did, but if you'll recall, this was part of our brief, that the custody evaluator had not reviewed. First of all, the custody evaluator said he reviewed the entire file. Ms. Albrecht asked him in trial about the recording that she provided to him, and he said, oh, I didn't record that. I didn't review that. So there's certainly holes in that testimony
as well. He did acknowledge he wouldn't have listened to it anyway in terms of how relevant it was, but didn't father also run into the same issue of not being able to rebut mother's testimony?
No, because he had the benefit of hearing mother's testimony first.
Well, let me rephrase it in terms of cross-examining.
Absolutely, but the difference is that the judge gave respondent father the opportunity to cross-examine Ms. Albrecht if he so chose.
Well, the judge also gave your client the opportunity to cross-examine father, but she chose not to do that.
Well, I think she just chose it by default in that she was presenting her case in chief and didn't understand, and that is also in our brief.
But the district court did remind her, too, of how much time, and if she wanted to cross-exam, to be aware of how much time that she had left. So it wasn't, I think the district court was mindful of her being self-represented and try to assist her to the extent that the district court can or should.
I don't disagree with that. I want to remind this court that the district court started off trial by saying, and this is a quote, and this is in our brief, if we can't cram everything in today, we do still have Friday. I don't think we need Friday, but I certainly want to get all the information. I think at most the district court was sending very mixed messages to respondent, or to, excuse me, to the appellant in this case. I also want to note that there was a hearing on July 27th, 2021, in which the district court set this case for 2 days. There is nothing on the record as to why the district court or when the district court changed it from 2 days to one.
Well, one part of the issue, I think, is in the findings that that you didn't challenge through, your client didn't challenge through a new trial motion. Mother's style of communication is obsessive, wandering, and excessive. People find it difficult to follow mother when she talks to them. She tends to provide long responses that cover many topics. And when I read that part of the court's order, it made me wonder how wisely your client used her time during trial.
I think that's a fair assessment. For a court to limit permanent physical custody, permanent legal custody for a child, for the rest of this child's minority to 1 day, I think in itself makes you wonder.
Well, and except that the court then went on to say, based on the observations of the multiple experts and the party's own testimony, the court concludes that it is mother's behavior and communication that is often interfering and controlling. And so I think the judge did take all of that into consideration when the judge made the determination that this child would be best served by both parents having equal parenting opportunity for the child.
There is nothing in this record that there were multiple experts involved in this case. There was the custody evaluator. And I think that that bleeds into another issue of the district court wholly adopting portions of respondents' proposed trial order without any record in the evidence for that. And the district court referencing multiple experts is just one example of that. The custody evaluator may be perceived as a quote-unquote expert, but it was the two parties and the custody evaluator. There's no evidence that there was any other experts in this case. My remaining time, I'm really out of time. I just want to say that the name change was primarily focused on the first name, and mother absolutely did not have a chance to respond to just father's last name. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted. And my chair is broken. Down.